I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, something is missing from much of North America's skies. A lot of birds have disappeared. Since 1970, the United States and Canada have lost an estimated 3 billion birds, nearly 1 in 3 birds across the continent. Grassland birds have been hit especially hard, and scientists warn that even some familiar backyard songbirds and wetland species are in decline. But they can bounce back. The roots of the threat to birds is clear: habitat loss, climate change, pesticides, invasive species, and the weakening of environmental protections. We can make changes to save the birds, to save the planet. How can we do that? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. North America has lost nearly 3 billion birds since 1970, a staggering decline that can be witnessed in quieter forest, emptier grasslands, and fewer birds passing overhead during migration. But Scott Weidensahl says the story of birds is not only a story of loss. In his new book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet, Weidensahl looks at what is happening when people act, when habitat is restored, dangerous chemicals are removed, nesting grounds are protected, and conservation is treated as more than just a sentimental cause. The result in some places is bird population recovery. Weidensahl is a naturalist, a researcher, and a Pulitzer Prize-nominated author whose work has long explored the wonder and fragility of bird migration. Scott Weidensahl, welcome to The Source.
Well, thank you so much, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
And our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You could also email us your questions and comments at thesource@tpr.org. Your book opens up saying it is a story of optimism, that you're optimistic. This is not a doom and gloom book, but I got to tell you, there's some doom, there's some gloom there.
Well, look, I'm a realist as well as an optimist, and I recognize, as you say, that you know the birds are in crisis, and that's not just happening in North America. There've been similar declines of birds in the UK, in Europe. This is a time of crisis for birds. But what that doesn't mean is that we should throw up our hands in despair and give up, because we have saved birds in the past, and we can do it again. There are clear roadmaps for recovery. And that's what I'm trying to lay out in this book, you know, give examples of how people have turned bird conservation around for, you know, in my lifetime in really remarkable ways. I graduated high school in 1976, and that year, that was the bicentennial year, there were maybe 1,000 bald eagles left in the lower 48. If you had told me as a, you know, 17, 18-year-old raptor nut, that by the time the country was celebrating its 250th anniversary, that there would be 400,000 bald eagles in the contiguous United States, that would have sounded delusional. That would have sounded like pie in the sky optimism. But we did it, and we brought back peregrine falcons and ospreys and a lot of other species that had suffered not just from DDT, but from centuries of persecution. In the latter half of the 20th century, we restored waterfowl populations to a degree that probably we hadn't seen since before the market hunting period of the late 19th and early 20th century. So, you know, we can do this. We've done it before. It just takes, willpower. It takes money. It takes political will. It takes the engagement of the general public to make it clear to our elected representatives that this is something that we value and that we want to see. It's not impossible. The only way it's impossible is if we don't try, quite frankly.
It also takes information, and seems like we're getting a lot of good information these days.
Oh, absolutely. There's been an absolute revolution in our understanding of birds. You know, you mentioned birds migrating at night. Until relatively recently, until the 1980s, the only way you could study nocturnal bird migration, which is when most birds migrate, was to literally sit outside with a spotting scope pointed at the moon and count the birds flying across the disk of the full moon. Well, now we've got Doppler radar and enough computing power to calculate, with incredible precision, exactly how many birds per cubic meter of airspace are passing over a city like San Antonio on any given night. And, and the cool thing is you can go on to birdcast.info on the web from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and some of its collaborators, and it will tell you, again, with extraordinary precision, exactly how many hundreds of thousands or millions of birds passed over through the airspace of your county the previous night during the spring and fall migration. Now, radar can't tell you what kind of birds are up there, but that's okay because we got eBird, which is, the world's largest wildlife observational database. Millions and millions of birders around the world submitting 100 million birding checklists to eBird every year and showing us with just incredible detail and granularity what species of birds are where and in what number at any given moment across North America and increasingly across the world. So with that information comes power. We can see what populations are rising, which populations are falling, where they're doing that, and it's giving us directions to take in making bird conservation actionable, decisions.
So we have all different types of birds, the raptors, as you mentioned, that you've seen the comeback, osprey, condor, eagles, but also the other songbirds, shorebirds, grassland birds, they're the ones that are really feeling the squeeze?
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned shorebirds. The title of the book is The Return of the Oyster Catcher, which is had been one of the common shorebirds along the Atlantic and Gulf Coast. This is the American oyster catcher. It's a species that, like most birds, in the latter half of the 19th century, in the first couple of years of the 20th, we were shooting like 100 million to 200 million birds a year in the United States, either for the pot, and they were sold in markets. You could walk into a market in Boston or New York City or Houston and buy, not just game birds, but, songbirds, robins. Robins were one of the most commonly sold birds for food in the United States. We put an end to that. Population started to rise again. Oyster catcher numbers started to come back up again because shorebirds were one of the groups of birds that were most heavily hunted for the market. But this is a bird that nests on the beach in the sand. And after World War II, America discovered it really loves the beach. And so oyster catchers and other beach nesting birds like least terns and piping plovers got crowded off those beaches. Their numbers started to fall again. And by the early part of the 21st century, oyster catcher numbers were just falling decade after decade after decade.
Was it because of the people being there or the trash that people were leaving behind attracting other varmints?
It was all of the above. So some of it was beach disturbance. Some of it was basically the way that we subsidize predators in our beach areas. Because like you say, there's overflowing trash barrels. There's lots of food for foxes and coyotes and raccoons. And, they're not above going out on the beach at night and finding, some tasty oyster catcher eggs or piping plover eggs.
Managing that is how you can help bring back the oyster catcher.
Right, exactly. So it gives you a roadmap for what to do. And it turns out it was pretty simple. If the scientists realized that working with oyster catchers realized if they could increase the productivity of each oyster catcher nest by just half a chick on average per pair per year, they could turn what would be another 10 or 12% decline over the next decade into about a 30% increase. And since 2008, when they implemented this plan with the cooperation of about 40 partner organizations and agencies and NGOs, oyster catcher numbers have risen about 45%. We've gone from about 11,000 to about 15,000 along the Atlantic Flyway. And this is an area where most shorebird numbers continue to fall.
Sounds like if you got good information, a plan of action, resources to deal with these things, good things can happen. We can restore certain bird populations. We're going to talk more about that after this break. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What is your favorite bird? Give us your spark bird story. What can we do? What can we do in ourselves, in our own backyard, to bring the birds back? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to helping Texas communities and emphasizing safety. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin. Davies with me online, Scott Weidensall. He's the author of The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet, talking about how we can adopt policies that will return the bird population to a healthy level. We've lost nearly 3 billion birds since 1970. So it does seem, though, that the current administration is adopting some policies that you would think would be challenging to the bird population. Number one, what's happening with public lands? I don't know if you want to, you know, help us understand that.
Oh yeah, there's no question that we are marching firmly in the wrong direction right now at the federal level. We've seen a hollowing out of a lot of the federal resource agencies. We've seen the Trump administration, for the second time — they did this during the first Trump administration — reinterpret the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which is kind of the foundational law under which all native wild birds are protected, and basically say that unless you intended to kill a bird, your actions you can't be prosecuted under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So, for example, if the Deepwater Horizon oil spill occurred today, BP would not be prosecuted under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, even though that oil spill killed, you know, millions and millions of birds. There is no question that some of the federal actions, and some of that also has just been driving a lot of really good people out of our federal resource agencies, out of the Fish and Wildlife Service, out of the U.S. Forest Service, out of the National Park Service. I've got a very good friend that was a national park biologist in Alaska for the better part of 40 years and retired because it became clear that the Park Service was going in the wrong direction. So, you know, we've got a deep hole that is unfortunately being dug deeper. And we've seen Supreme Court action, what was known as the Sackett case a couple of years ago, that stripped federal protection from about 95% of the wetlands in the United States under the Clean Water Act. So, you know, again, I'm not suggesting everything is hunky-dory for birds, because we are at a crisis point here. But it's important for us to recognize that we've done seemingly impossible things in the past, and, you know, we can do it again. I wish we were starting from a better point, but at some point the work of recovery is going to resume, and, you know.
Yeah, but this is public policy, and the public should have a voice, and they should need to be made aware what is happening, and this is impacting birds. But birds, it's not okay, birds, but birds are an important part of the entire ecosystem. And as we're, you know, whittling down the overall population, that's going to have, you know, I hate to, you know, the canary in the coal mine. I've heard the phrase now, we're surrounded by dead canaries.
Well, and you're talking to somebody here who grew up in the coal region of Pennsylvania with coal miners in my family tree. So the notion of canaries in the coal mine is a very real one to me. And yeah, I mean, we can vote. I would suggest if people are concerned about birds, that they vote the environment. You know, that's that you want a way to make policymakers pay attention to them. You know, cast a ballot at the ballot box. It makes a difference for them. You know, call your representatives up. I know a lot of conservative birders. It's not really necessarily a red-blue divide. You know, for example, I know an awful lot of very conservative duck hunters, and one of the reasons that ducks have done so well over the last half century is because there's a lot of people out there, whether they like watching ducks or like hunting ducks, doesn't matter. They recognize the value of habitat and protection for those birds. And one of the big conservation success stories we've had during the latter half of the 20th century was recovering waterfowl populations through some landmark legislation, the North America Wetlands Conservation Act, or NACA, the North American Waterfowl Management Plan, which was this amazing multinational, transnational waterfowl management plan between Canada and the United States and Mexico, poured billions of dollars into restoring and protecting and enhancing wetland habitat. And, you know, if you build it, they will come. Waterfowl populations have surged over the last 50 years to a dramatic extent. And, you know, you mentioned grassland birds. If we did the same thing for grassland habitats that we did for wetland habitats, we could bring back the grassland birds like lesser prairie chickens and upland sandpipers and grasshopper sparrows and meadowlarks that are in so much trouble across the country. It's a matter of finding the political will for that.
Well, we can do for quail. You know, we have people, quail hunters, and
Oh,
we
yeah.
know that when you restore a little bit of your ranch land, the quail return.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a growing number of ranchers out there that recognize that it's possible to make a profit off their land, both a financial profit and a natural history and wildlife profit. I profile a couple of them in the book, in fact. Two ranchers in southeastern Colorado, a fellow named Russell Davis at the Weiniger Davis Ranch near Carville, and a fellow named Grady Grissom, who runs the Rancho Largo Cattle Company. And these are two people that come from very, very different backgrounds. You know, one is a generational rancher who was, you know, kind of appalled to find out that he had rare mountain plovers on his ranch and was concerned that the government's going to come in and take the whole ranch away from him. The other, a Stanford-trained geologist who tried to make a living off a ranch, running it the way that his grandparents had run ranches in Colorado and Nebraska, and almost went bankrupt. And then realized, both of them, that if they started ranching with nature rather than in opposition with nature, they could make a living, they could make a good living for themselves, and they could restore the vitality of the land. And one of those barometers of that vitality are the number of birds on those ranches. And it's funny, Grady Grissom at Rancho Largo, he can barely tell a pigeon from a crow. He laughs about the fact that he's not a birder. But I have rarely been in a short grass prairie environment where I saw as many birds and such a diversity of birds as I did on that land. And he got there by focusing on restoring the biological and ecological complexity of his grasslands. He is all about ecological complexity, and that just ripples out from the diversity of grasses that he's growing for his cattle that spend 12 months of the year out on the range. They're entirely grass-fed, and it just ripples through every other aspect of biodiversity on his property. So there are ways to do this, and there are more and more ranchers across the country that are starting to embrace that because they recognize it doesn't have to be an either-or situation.
So I want to clear up the point that you raised about if you have a bird species on your land that the government won't come in and take your land away. That doesn't happen, right?
No, it really doesn't. But you know, but there's such a distrust in many parts of rural America, especially in ranch country, such a distrust of the federal government that when Russell Davis found out he had all these mountain plovers in, and especially when he took steps to protect those mountain plovers and put his ranch under a conservation easement, he was frozen out by the rest of the community in that part of southeastern Colorado. I mean, other ranchers stopped calling him. They stopped inviting him. You know, there was no more neighboring. He wasn't invited to come out and help with branding. He was socially isolated, even from members of his own family. And it took a while before they realized that he'd made a really wise decision. For one thing, the money that came in from that conservation easement paid off a huge debt that they were carrying from years of drought, where they'd been paying for hay for year after year after year. But they also realized that the small community of Carville, population 39, realized that they actually had a tourism draw in the form of these rare mountain plovers. Colorado is kind of the heart of the mountain plovers range. And you know, as he pointed out at a community revival meeting where they were talking about how they could sort of revitalize this little tiny community, he said, you know, there's a lot of people out there would like to come see this rare bird. He said, maybe we should start one of these bird festivals. Now, you got to understand, Carville, population 39, there's no hotel, there's no restaurant, there's no gas station, there's no convenience store, they have no infrastructure for hosting people from out of town. And Russell's idea was, well, we ought to put them up in our homes and invite people to come and stay with us. And so that's what people do. And this is, I think this year is the 20th anniversary of the Carvel Mountain Plover Festival, usually about 50 or 60 people. Some people camp, but for the most part, when they come and they stay in, you know, on the farm, they stay on the ranch with the ranch families, pay them a small fee to do that, and then get out and not just see the birds, but start to see the landscape and the community from the ranching community's perspective. And that's one of the most important things I think you can do, is build bridges between people. You know, environmentalists and ranchers have not always seen eye to eye. I'm sure that's not going to be a surprise to anybody listening to this program. But what the Carvel Mountain Plover Festival has done over the last 20 years is it's built really solid bridges of communication between the birding and environmental community in Colorado and the ranching community in southeastern Colorado. People that once saw themselves as adversaries now see themselves as, in many cases, friends, very good friends.
Let's go to a caller, 833-877-8255, Mathide. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but Mathide, you're on the air. Hello?
Is it Matilde?
Okay, Matilde. Okay, got it. I'm sorry I messed that up. Matilde, you're on
the
air.
No, not a problem. Yes, one of the things that I wanted to mention was how can we work with the city of San Antonio with spreading misinformation? Because we've been having the deterrent here for the last 3-4 years here in San Antonio, and we know that San Antonio is known for a bird city and a big bird population that migrate and stop here, right? They've been deterred from 3 of our parks, Breckenridge, Elmendorf, Woodlawn. And the thing is that it is the misinformation that they've been spreading about having diseases. So San Antonio has not been doing a good job, I guess, protecting their nesting season for the last 3-4 years. One of my favorite birds is the double-crested cormorant, because it ties into our creation story as indigenous people along the Yanawana San Antonio River. So what can we do here in San Antonio?
All right, Matilde.
We know that they've lost a lot of the native habitat too as well.
Matilde, thank you very much. So the city of San Antonio has been pushing back on bird populations, saying that they interfere with aviation and other things.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things going on here. For one thing, I mean, birds can pose a risk to aviation. There's no question about that. You know, we all remember, you know, the miracle on the Hudson a couple of years ago. It's mostly flocking birds. You know, this guy got to take out both engines on a jet to cause a problem. I've been involved for a long time in studying snowy owls, which are attracted to airports in the northern United States and southern Canada. And, you know, they were looking at ways to move them away from airports. On the other hand, you know, there are certainly non-lethal ways to haze birds away from airstrips. It's not necessary to, you know, just get out there and start shooting them, and certainly not, you know, removing large populations of birds in the vicinity of airports. In fact, in the wake of the, you know, the miracle on the Hudson, where, you know, Sully Sullenberger brought that plane with no engines down on the Hudson, they'd hit a flock of Canada geese. And in the wake of that incident, the city of New York went on kind of a killing spree, killing a lot of the non-migratory resident Canada geese in the areas around some of their municipal, you know, some of their metropolitan airports. Except that an analysis of the feathers and tissue from the geese that hit the plane, they were migrant geese that had come in from outside. They didn't know the area. The local birds are usually fine. They tend to avoid those airstrips. So it's a shame. I live in New Hampshire. I have not been following what's been going on in San Antonio. I'm a little reluctant to try to speak to details on a situation that I'm not really familiar with. But, you know, there's a lot of airport authorities out there. They're working pretty hard to mitigate and minimize the risk of birds at airports. You know, with our snowy owl work, we've been working closely with airports for years on trapping and relocating snowy owls away from airports rather
than
taking...
This is where the community can get involved, help educate the local officials, protest, write letters, call into radio shows, raise their concerns, educate people, and to say the solution is not to wipe out the birds, it's to figure out how to live with the birds. And we're going to talk more about that when we come back from this break. We're speaking with Scott Weidensall. His book is The Return of the Oyster Catchers, Saving Birds to Save the Planet. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues after this break. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Bird populations have fallen. The great migration multitudes, they are no longer as great as they once were. The future of birds may seem grim, but there are success stories. There are lessons to be learned about how some bird populations have been restored and now they're soaring. What are those lessons? How can we apply them here locally and across the nation, across the world? We're speaking with Scott Weidensall. He is the author of The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet. You can call in at 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So bird migration, how does light pollution, how is that impacting bird migration?
Oh, that's a really great question. Light pollution has a couple of effects on birds. It can, because most birds, as I said before, are migrating after dark. Even birds like songbirds that are normally active in the daytime, they do almost all of their migration at night. The night air is cooler, it's less turbulent. They use the stars overhead for an orientation cue as they're navigating. But that means that artificial light at night can really mess them up, and particularly in the fall, because in the fall migration, you have a lot of young birds on their first migration heading south. And when they get near metropolitan areas, urban areas where there's a lot of light pollution, they tend to be drawn to it, you know, a little bit like moths to a flame. They become disoriented, and then bad things happen. They get drawn, first of all, they get drawn into urban areas where when daylight comes, there's not a lot of place for them to go. You know, they find themselves in, you know, the concrete canyons of Manhattan, for example. One of the reasons Central Park is such an important place for migratory birds in the Northeast. They hit windows, they fly into skyscrapers. They can just sometimes just become so exhausted that they simply fall out of the sky.
That was with the 9/11 spotlights?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the what they call the Tribune and lights, the two spotlights beaming straight up into the night sky. And in fact, when that was first proposed in the wake of 9/11, ornithologists warned the city of New York that if you do this, you are going to kill birds. And they did it anyway, and they discovered, you know, just as predicted, that within a very short period of time, because, you know, September 11th is kind of at the peak of fall songbird migration in the Northeast. It's just kind of an unhappy coincidence. And you soon get dozens and then hundreds and then sometimes thousands of birds milling around in those beams of light. And to their credit, to the credit of the city of New York, they recognize the problem, and they now work they no longer call themselves Audubon Society of New York, Bird Alliance of New York, and the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and they actually use radar to monitor how many birds are in that beam of light. And once there are enough birds in there to start to cause issues, they turn the light off for a period of time, let those birds disperse. But it's still, you know, when you think about the amount of light, especially along the eastern seaboard, you know, the I-95 corridor down from Boston to New York, to Philadelphia, to Washington, D.C., it's a real gauntlet for birds. And so anything that we can do In San Antonio, in Texas as a whole, during spring and fall migration, especially if it's going to be a big migration night, and you can tell when it's going to be a big migration night, because if you go to Birdcast, which we mentioned before, you can get a prediction on what the migration intensity in your area is going to be on any given night. And just if you have outside lights, just turn them off.
I wonder about the border wall between Texas and Mexico, yeah. particularly in South Texas, around Brownsville, and these areas in the Rio Grande Valley. They have these massive floodlights attached to the border wall that shine mm-hmm. brightly from sundown to sun up. And if that is a problem for migrating birds.
I suspect it's probably less of a problem, quite frankly, than the urban environments, because it's a very limited space. They're going to fly over that and they're going to pass it by pretty quickly. You may get some birds that are, temporarily disoriented by those lights, but as long as it's fairly dark on either side, that's probably not an issue. I'm much more concerned with just the huge metropolitan areas.
And cities can participate in this, like San Antonio. This is a migrating bird corridor. They can yep. coordinate and have nights out events.
Absolutely. And in fact, it's getting easier and easier. There are some companies now that will work with municipalities to automate lights out on municipal buildings that are tied into predictions from Cornell and Birdcast, if it's going to be a big night. Really, in any given metropolitan area, whether we're talking about cities in Texas or cities farther north in the Northeast, the migration comes through in waves, and there's usually only 5 or 6 nights in the spring and 5 or 6 nights in the fall when there's going to be really intense migration in, whether we're talking about Cleveland or, Toledo or wherever. And those nights are now easily predictable. We can look at the weather. We can look at what's coming. We can look at radar and say, okay, tomorrow night, San Antonio, this is going to be a big night. So let's turn out the lights in the skyscrapers. Let's make it a safer night for birds. We don't have to inconvenience people night after night for months at a time. It's really just these limited nights. And
right. Just be smart about it.
Yeah, let's just be smart about it.
I'm going to go to a caller. Frank's been holding for a while. And Frank, I want to get you on the air. Frank, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a question. I'm sorry, go ahead. I have a question about conservation of quail in the Texas Hill Country area. It's my understanding that, at least in part, one of the reasons that the population is down is intrusion of pigs and eating the eggs since they're ground nesting. And I'm wondering if could talk about in the Hill Country specifically what might be able to be done to help bring the quail population back. Is it keeping the pigs out, or is there more to it?
Yeah, the feral hogs, they're a scourge. So, Scott?
Well, I mean, I have not done any quail hunting in the Hill Country of Texas, much as I might like to. So I may not be the best person to be asking that question of.
If anyone can figure out how to deal with feral hogs, they'd be rich.
Yeah, the crazy thing is, one of the things that I write about in the book is the rewilding efforts that are going on in Europe, where they're trying to bring back lost species to the landscape, which in many cases are wild hogs. They're trying to bring back wild boar.
They can have some of ours. And
I know. Well, that's just it.
That's not the right species. Yeah.
It isn't, and yeah, but I know. In talking to my friends in the UK, where they've used they're naturally in the UK, they're not allowed to release wild boar, and so in these rewilding projects, they're using domestic analogs of some of these wild animals, including Tamworth pigs, which are like 600 pounds, of these gigantic brick ribs, wow. Like a boulder out there in the meadow. But from their perspective, the rooting that they're doing is, that's what the forests of Europe evolved with. Wild boars were, they were part of that landscape originally, where they are not here. But yeah, feral hogs are just such a scourge on the landscape and spreading. It's no longer just a Texas problem. I mean, you get those super hogs up in the Canadian prairie provinces that are, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds, really kind of terrifying.
Let's go to Deborah on the phones. And Deborah, you're on the air. Go ahead, Deborah.
Hi there. Yeah, I just wanted to make a couple of comments because I heard the previous speaker talk about the issues with the city of San Antonio and how they're not doing their part to be the bird city. There's a lot of locations, there's several locations where the city of San Antonio is focusing their efforts and they're nowhere near airports. So it's very concerning, especially because we spent a lot of money, thousands of dollars, a couple years back, fixing the Olmos Basin area, restoring its ecosystem specifically to help the birds. There's a one pager, you can Google it, anybody can. And then now they're spending thousands of dollars hiring employees by the Parks and Recreation Department to clap to scare birds from migrating, specifically the white egret, which at one time was a species that was almost out. They've restored, the egret has been restored, and we're doing our part to unrestore them. So it's very concerning to see the city of San Antonio doing these things. There's an actual lawsuit right now to save a particular area where the birds nest every year. And the city of San Antonio is spending thousands and thousands of dollars to fight this lawsuit. It's going to go all the way to the Supreme Court, and so will San Antonio, in order to chop all of the trees down in that area so that the birds won't nest. You know.
All right, Deborah, thank you for that. So you can see these workers from the San Antonio Parks and Recreation, they're walking around with 2x4s, slapping them together to scare their birds away. Sometimes they might use some fireworks. Is this normal? Does this happen in other cities, Scott?
Not in cities that consider themselves bird cities. I'm a little baffled by why you would restore habitat that attracts birds and then try to drive the birds away from it. That makes absolutely no sense to me.
But it is happening. I can tell you. I've reported on it.
I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that. I'm just you know, rather baffled why somebody would do that. It seems like a waste of time, seems like a waste of money, seems like a waste
of
money.
It seems like people don't understand what's happening. And so they have these oscillating policies. There's not an overall bird understanding of what's going on with the city. And so, it's a confusing lot because the people making the decision seem to be confused. But I'm not confused about this. I got to hit this break. And we're going to come back. We'll get some other callers on the air. You can call in at 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet with Scott Wiederman. Wiedersol, when we come back, stay with us. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. Scott Wiedersol is with us. The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet is his book. And let's go to Alicia on the phones. Alicia, you're on the air.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, you sound great.
Okay, sorry. So I was going to actually bring up the thing about how can we promote conservation if we have a city that is not willing to look at the conservation needs of our migratory egrets and herons, because there are species that are listed as needing conservation. And as it was mentioned earlier, there are contractors banging 2x4s and shooting explosives. The other thing which I want to throw in there is that we do have a zoo that has a lot of endangered species of birds in there that are also being subjected to the noise of the explosive pyrotechnics daily. I mean, if we're trying to promote conservation, especially of our endangered animals, why is that even right to do that?
Well, we can't answer that question, but we hear your concern, and so thank you for calling with that. But I want to ask you about an email from a listener. It says feral cats are one of the biggest contributors to bird death, and SA Catch and Release Program is a large part of this problem. So you write about feral cats and actually indoor-outdoor cats having a hand in deaths of birds.
Yeah, in fact, I think it would surprise a lot of people to understand that cats are the single leading cause of, human-related bird mortality in the United States. Not wind turbines, not windows, not cars. Between 2 and 4 billion birds a year are killed by cats in the United States, and that's feral cats. That's cats at these, managed cat colonies, trap, neuter, and release colonies. That's house pets that are allowed outside. If the simplest thing that we can do as individuals just to protect birds is if we have a cat, just please keep it in the house. That ought to be the low-hanging fruit. Now, unfortunately, the reality is that the issue of cats and birds is a really polarizing one. There's some very well-organized cat advocates out there that will swear up and down that that cats are not killing birds, that that those are made-up numbers, and cats really are not a threat to birds. But the science is really clear. I mean, people have spent a lot of time, putting radio collars on feral cats and house cats and following them around and seeing, seeing how many birds they kill. Anybody who thinks their cat doesn't kill birds is probably just not paying attention, unless the cat stays in the house. And I'm speaking as somebody who's owned a bunch of cats over the years. I really like cats, but my cats have never gone outside, and those cats for sure have never killed birds. So, people often ask, what can I do to save birds? One of the simplest things you can do is if you keep a cat, don't let it outside.
Well, how bad are wind turbines? Donald Trump frequently says that they're terrible for birds and that we shouldn't have clean energy because what it does to birds.
I really wish I could believe that Donald Trump cared all that much about birds. I don't really think he does. Based on all of his other, the, most of the other actions of his administration, wind turbines are a mixed bag. They definitely kill birds. There's no doubt. It's like real estate. It's location, location, location. There are some places that are better suited to wind turbines than others from a bird migration perspective. Wind turbines can also deter birds from going into an area, and this is a concern increasingly as we see wind development in offshore areas where seabirds, many of which hunt at night, may actually be deterred from going into areas where they've always foraged because of these, enormous numbers of new turbines going in there. But the flip side of that is climate change is affecting every moment of every day of every bird's life now. It is a problem. It's changing the seasons. It's changing the timing of the seasons. It's changing the intensity of winds and storms and, what food is available where for migratory birds. And so, finding the balance between those two is difficult. There ain't no such thing as a free lunch. And so I think the siting of turbines is of particular importance. We have to figure out where the best and worst places are and avoid use the best and avoid the worst.
Bird Save Glass, a email from a listener brings up installing Bird Save Glass. How effective is that?
Really effective. If you can find it can be expensive, but it's not expensive to retrofit your windows. Okay, I mentioned that cats kill 2 to 4 billion birds a year. Windows take out another 1 billion birds, and it happens. It's such a widely scattered way that I don't think people really, for a long time, understood the magnitude of the problem. Our house here in New Hampshire, we've got screens on the outsides of all our windows, except for a sliding glass door on the deck. And every year we lose a couple of birds to that sliding glass door. And then I bought something, and I'm going to use a brand name here. I have no relation to the company, and I'm not getting anything from it. It's called Feather Friendly. They're based in Canada, and what they're doing is they're capitalizing on the fact that most birds can see in the ultraviolet range, which we can't. So anything that reflects ultraviolet light really stands out to a bird. And this manufacturer, and there's other manufacturers that do similar things, they manufacture a clear plastic tape with tiny little, oh, they're like 1/8 inch square UV reflective squares. And you can, put these things, array these things in lines on your window and rub them on, and then pull the tape away, and it leaves these little squares behind, these little dots. and to a bird from the outside, instead of looking now like this to a bird, you know, you look at the glass and it looks like you can just fly into it. They see the reflection of trees and clouds and the land. Now it looks like a solid object. And since we put those up, I have not had a single bird hit that sliding glass door. And it was simple. It took an hour or two on an afternoon. You're looking through these dots, looking out. So there's some visual interference there, but not very much. And to be honest with you, I think after about 3 days, my wife and I stopped noticing it. And it's been a huge difference for the birds. So, you know, there are solutions here for some of these problems. And again, kind of low hanging fruit. And just multiply that by across millions of homes and millions of windows, it can make a huge difference for birds.
What can homeowners do in their own backyard? They don't have a huge multi-acre spread, but they got a little bit of yard. Can they do things to help the birds?
Absolutely. You don't need a multi-acre spread. In fact, I would argue that if you can multiply the millions of small properties out there, and just do a couple of things, I would suggest, for one thing, to garden and landscape with native plants. You want to bind together broken ecological connections rather than planting exotic species from the other side of the world that don't have any ecological connection to where you're living. And particularly if you can focus on woody shrubs that are going to produce native woody shrubs that are going to produce fruit in late summer and early fall. And I hear people kind of complaining sometimes, like, you know, they're planting dogwoods or viburnums and produce these really lush fruits in late summer, and they're gone like immediately because the birds ate them. Well, that's the idea. These fruits are high in lipids, so they allow the birds to lay on fat for their migration. And so we're talking about birds like tanagers and thrushes and catbirds, that feed very heavily on fruit, some of the vireos. And that's the energy that's going to carry these birds on their migration to the neotropics. You know, some of these birds are going to be flying thousands of miles on their migration. And if every homeowner, whether they have a small patch in town or a big property out in the country, planted just a small area of these native fruit producing shrubs and trees, would make a huge difference for migratory birds.
What about oak trees?
Oak trees are fantastic. Dr. Doug Tallamy at the University of Delaware, who's he's written a lot of great books, and Bringing Nature Home is one of his best. He's made the point that an oak tree, because oaks support so many insects, and because during the breeding season, most birds, regardless of what the adult bird eats, most birds feed their chicks insects. Oak trees produce a huge bounty of soft-bodied insects, especially caterpillars. And you know, a family of Carolina chickadees, it's like they need like 4,000 to 9,000 caterpillars over the course of 2 weeks to feed a clutch of four babies. So, you know, it's a tremendous amount of work for the birds to collect that food, and oak trees do a really good job of providing that food for them.
So as the bird population has declined, how has that impacted the wider ecosystem?
Oh, in so many ways. Birds are really effective dispersers of seeds. It comes back to fruit. We were just talking about it a moment ago, you know, that when the bird gulps down a fruit whole and then poops the seeds out later with a little bit of fertilizer, I might add, they do a terrific job of spreading those seeds across the environment. They do an incredible job of insect control. I read a figure some years ago that migratory birds provide about, and this was in probably $1980, so, you know, much more than that today, about $5,000 in insect control per acre of forested habitat out there. And then there's I get uncomfortable talking about the economic value of birds, you know, because I think we as a species tend to boil things down to economics. You know, there's also the spiritual value of birds. We here in the Northeast had a really hard winter this year. It was like really deep snow, really deep cold. I cannot tell you how much I am waiting for the waves of neotropical migrants to get back north here. And the first ones are just arriving, black-throated green warblers and yellow-rumped warblers, other birds like that. Yeah. I know they're coming because a week ago I was down on the upper Gulf Coast in Texas around Beaumont, which is like ground zero for those trans-Gulf migrants coming across now.
Yeah.
You know, that restoring all of that color and life and song to the forest, you know,
I gotta go. Scott Widensall, thank you so much. The return of the oyster catcher saving birds to save the planet. Thank you.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.